This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. The New York Times reported last month that the automaker Nissan bought an island and created a driving course to promote its new Sentra model. But while Nissan paid real money for the promotional assets, the island and driving course were imaginary. They were digital images in the online interactive game Second Life, one of several computer games where tens or hundreds of thousands of players at a time interact in a virtual world. Reuters has even opened a news bureau in Second Life. My guest Julian DeBell spent more than a year playing the game Ultima Online, and he's written a book about one of the more bizarre outgrowths of the online game world, the sale of imaginary assets, weapons, houses, and gold, on eBay and other auction sites for real money. Some traders in virtual goods, he says, are making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, blurring the line between play and work in a digital age. His book is called Play Money, or How I Quit My Day Job and Made Millions Trading Virtual Loot. Well, Julian DeBell, welcome to Fresh Air. I wonder if you could start maybe by sharing with our audience a sense of what it's like to be in these online role-playing games where you're interacting with people all over the country. And you describe this fascinating moment where you are in a game and you've gotten in the habit of killing these lizard men, which I gather you take the skins and then you can take them to the bank of this imaginary world and sell them for money. And you have an encounter right. with another player after you make the deal.
Right, right. I've gone and this is a very relaxing, stress-relieving activity to go into the dungeons and slay these lizard men who, when I was an early arrival to this virtual world, slew me a lot. So now that I've gotten enough powers, it's fun to go in and just slaughter them randomly and take their skins. But as I was heading back into the dungeon, there was a stranger there, another player hanging out. And he, sort of typed, what's up? And I was like, hi. And suddenly I'm seeing these strange words appearing and flashes of lightning and so forth. And I realize he's attacking me with magic spells. And he's much more powerful than I am. And before I know it, I'm dead and he's looting me. And then because there's not that much loot on my body, he kills my horse just for the hell of it and says, next time bring something I can really use and maybe I won't kill your horse.
Now, let's just take a step back here and widen the lens a little bit. These things are called MPORGs, right? Massively multiplayer online role-playing games. Paint a bit of a picture of this world for the audience.
Yeah, MMORPGs, more pigs or MMOs, are one of the fastest growing sectors of the computer games business. World of Warcraft is the market leader right now. It has almost 7 million players worldwide. And there are probably another 3 million people playing various other games. And each one of these games can have hundreds of thousands of people interacting at any one time. And it's very complex interaction because some people want to kill this monster, some people want to kill that monster, other people just want to become tradespeople in the game, become armor makers or sword makers. And they all rely on each other for different resources. And so this produces very complex social and ultimately economic interactions.
So, and there's real estate, there are islands, there are homes, and some people trade, some people buy, some people sell.
Right, exactly. There are some people even sell the accounts, the characters themselves, once they've been built up to a certain level. You can sell to somebody else who just, buying a fancy car or something that they want to take out into the world and show off their stuff.
Now, where it gets really weird, of course, is where you have these imaginary assets, potions, homes, skills, and gold pieces, which they're used to evaluate them in the imaginary economy, mm-hmm. and then those get converted into real hard American dollars. And early in the book, you describe a guy named Lee Caldwell who has a business called Black Snow Interactive. Mm-hmm. What mm-hmm. is their business?
Let me back it up and sort of explain this whole phenomenon, which really boggles most people's minds that have never played these games or known someone who did. It happens that these items are all very difficult to acquire. The point of the game is that it's hard to acquire this magic sword or that castle or this pile of gold pieces that will allow you to buy those things. And many people lack the patience or the time to really commit to the 80 hours or so it will take to get a sword of ultimate orc slaying. And yet they have friends who are pulling ahead in the game and they want to keep up with them, or, you know, for various reasons, they will say, well, look, instead of putting in all those hours sitting there clicking and running around, why don't I just go on eBay and see if somebody there is selling the Sword of Ultimate Orc Slaying for real money? And, a very valuable, rare, powerful weapon, they might find being sold for, you know, $500 or $600 and happily pay it. And so these guys that you mentioned, Lee Caldwell and his Black Snow business, were in that kind of line of business. But what they were also doing was getting into the manufacturing side of it, the production end. So, and that's called farming, which is when your business is to go into the wilderness and mine for ore over and over again, or slay the lizard men over and over again, and just take those items that you have produced and take and sell them at market yourself without dealing with the middleman.
And which sounds awfully time-consuming. I'm out there learning some online skill, mining an ore or slaying lizards, and I've got to get good enough to make money at it. Can you hire other people to do it?
Well, that's...
That was the rumor, right?
That was the rumor. I'd heard that was going on. It turns out Lee Caldwell was the first person I've ever confirmed of actually doing that, and he was he worked in a... out of Southern California, and he and his boys had gone down to Tijuana and rented an office space and set up 8 workstations there and run in an internet line and hired 24 unskilled Mexican laborers to play these games, you know, in round the clock shifts, which, you know, sounds like a bizarre thing to think of, but, you know, if you do the math and you think, well, you know, somebody in this game can produce, you know, $3 worth of valuable stuff just by playing in an hour. If I can go somewhere where the going labor rate is, you know, $1 an hour or less, then it seems stupid not to.
If you're just joining me, my guest is Julian DeBell. He has a new book called Play Money, or How I Quit My Day Job and Made Millions Trading Virtual Loot. And if this sounds a little weird, that's because it's a little weird. We're talking about how Julian and other people have made real money by immersing themselves in online role-playing games involving thousands of other players and then accumulating imaginary assets and selling them for real money. I'd like you to tell the story of this one fellow you met, Bob Kiblinger, if I have the name right.
Mm-hmm.
And he buys the account of a fellow named Troy Stoll.
Troy Stoley, yeah.
Stoley, right. And in effect, he here's what Troy Stoley has, his assets in the game, mm-hmm. negotiates a good price. And tell us, what does he get in Troy Stoley's game account and what he does with it?
Well, Troy Stoley was a union carpenter in Indianapolis who had been fanatically playing the game for many months and acquired a lot of skills, and ultimately acquired his most valuable asset was a large tower. The real estate market in Ultima Online was very strong at the time. And through his efforts, he had built himself a large tower, which is a 3-story affair. And after 9/11, he lost his job, and, you know, he had a kid to raise, and so he sold his account to Bob Kiblinger for $500. Bob is a guy who lives in West Virginia and does this for a living, and a very good living it is. He had been a chemist at Procter & Gamble before quitting it to go into the business, and his name is on a patent for Febreze, and he was having a lot more fun trading items and ultimately made a lot more money. Does, you know, 6 figures easily.
He makes over $100,000 a year buying and trading these virtual assets.
Yes, and that's putting it mildly. So he, you know, he went through Troy Stoley's whole account. You know, he found lots of sort of rare treasures and things, and he would break them all out and put them up on his website, which was sort of just a big shopping mall, a big department store for Ultima Online items. And then he broke out the tower itself as a separate item and put it on eBay and priced it at $750 and very quickly got a taker. Forget the guy's name, but he was a Wonder Bread delivery man in Oklahoma, and he was the one who bought it. And I talked to him a bit about it, and that was what he explained. I said, "Look, you know, you're not a rich man. Why is it that you would spend, you know, $750 on this imaginary house?" And he said, "You just, what can I say? You go around as a young player, as a noob, looking at these fancy houses. You wonder who lives there. How did they acquire the wealth to get there? What kind of person are they?" And it just makes you an object of regard to own a big house, and he wanted to have it.
Now, so we have these assets that some are acquired by just making smart deals and buying them for other players who either are getting out of the game or just want to get rid of them. Some cases you actually generate the assets by playing the game, mining for gold, etc. And then you discover that there are some people who have taken this yet another step by inventing computer macros, which in effect act like people replicating tasks would generate wealth, right?
Right. A guy named Rich Thurman, who I spoke to at length, had in his closet, he sent me a photograph of it, 21 machines, it was ultimately 50 computers, each one running two or three instances of the game. And on each one of those, you know, an automated worker robot going into the mountains or running around from vendor to vendor doing things that would produce gold. And so this was wonderful for him. You know, he would come home in the evening. He had a day job, a well-paying one. And in the evening, he would come home and, you know, and twiddle with his robots and make sure everything was running on track and then go to bed and, you know, in the morning wake up and check how much gold had piled up in his bank box and sell it off to some eBay marketer like myself. And he made, I think it was $81,000 in the year that I spoke to him, just working his army of worker robots.
So you have a character in the game, and one way to do it is to have an underpaid foreign worker manipulating the character. But his way was to write a computer program so that you, in effect, had a robot replicating these tasks, generating gold pieces. Now, the people who run the game, I gather, send around cops, in effect, right? And try and talk to the robots to see if they're a real person or a robot. How does that work?
Right. Well, this is obviously, you know, against the rules, right? If anything is, this is sort of the ultimate form of cheating. So the game masters, the cops, have developed these tricks for going in and interrogating these workers, you know, to see if they're real people or not. And so it becomes a game of, you know, an arms race where the games masters will get into this interrogation, and then the robot designers will rewrite their robots to sort of see, you know, as soon as the game master walks into the area, they'll suddenly type something like, "Oh gosh, I have to go to the bathroom, I'll be right back," and log off. So you never quite get the proof. But then the game masters come up with this, okay, here's another one, you know, if we can engage them long enough, we'll hold up a little colored wand, you know, and say, "What color is my wand?" And, you know, because it's very hard to read the colors, you know, just with a computer program.
So in other words, what we have is the game master is, in effect, a cop for the administrators of the game. He sees a character, talks to it to see if it responds like a human or a robot.
Right.
And then the robots are getting better at responding in ways. And one of the ways to trick them is to hold up something colorful and say, what color is it? And a robot won't know.
Right. And so basically it's an elaborate, you know, version of the Turing test, you know, which was Alan Turing's, you know, how will we know if computers have intelligence? Well, as soon as they can, you know, fool somebody in a conversation, that's that. And it has happened. And one of the things that Rich came up with that was brilliant was once they started doing this wand waving thing, he had his robots designed to, as soon as a game master walked in the room, send a message to him on his cell phone so that wherever he was.
Send a message to Rich, not the
to game. Rich, yes. Right. On
the,
his cell phone.
The real human being.
Right, yeah. Game, you know, if he was at home, dinner with his family, he would hop up and get on the computer and say, hey, what's up? You know, it's just me sitting here, you know, innocent little me, just mining away. And they'd say, okay.
Now, how big do these operations get? I mean, these ones that are dedicated to generating imaginary wealth like this?
Well, as I said, there was, you know, Rich eventually had 50 computers going in his closet. I recently visited China, where the innovation of Lee Caldwell, which was kind of a flash in the pan at the time, has now become a full-blown industry there. There are probably 1,000 gold farms there, as they're called, factories where workers are being paid to play these games. And they will have, you know, 50 or 75 workers at one spot. And then, as I said, multiplied by, you know, maybe 1,000 throughout the country.
So this is a place in China, or many places, where you would have, in effect, a computer warehouse and people hired to sit all day replicating tasks in a computer game to generate imaginary wealth, which is then sold for real money.
Exactly, yeah. The robots, you know, take a lot of babysitting. You know, they'll get hung up on certain, you know, they'll get caught in the trees as they're running around or something, and you need occasionally to check in and unsnag them. So you'll be paying a Chinese laborer 25 cents to watch 3 or 4 robots at a time instead of just playing one at a time. But, you know, and it all sounds very industrialized and demystified and not very fun at all. And when I went, I imagined that these workers would be, you know, desperate, you know, immigrants from the poorer provinces of China, you know, just off the bus from Fujian or wherever, and, you know, just corralled into these shops. Well, you know, okay, I'll do this. And that the people running the factories would be sort of middle-aged businessmen looking for any angle they could. But in fact, they were all gamers. The workers and the owners had all started out as avid players of these games and been drawn to this business for that reason. And even though the conditions are grueling, 12-hour days, one day off a month in the one shop I was at, $4 a day for this work, they're all clearly still playing on some level. They're all gathering around each other, you know, giving advice about how to deal with this or that monster or, you know, that type of, you know, strategy. And they're all still engaged in some way as gamers, even though they recognize it as a dead-end job and very grueling and so forth. It's a very – I thought, though, when I got to these sweatshops that I would be witnessing, you know, the ultimate triumph of work over play and the death of play. And yet, fascinatingly, it was all confused. And in their, you know, 2 hours of free time that they have, you know, after, you know, the shift gets off and they have to go to bed in their workers' quarters, you know, 5 guys to a room on plywood bunks. It fascinated me to see that one of the most popular things to do to relax and unwind was to go downstairs to the internet cafe in the same building and play the exact same games they had been working for another 2 or 3 hours.
Oh, my heavens.
And thoroughly excited and engaged. I'm still processing that. I don't know what to make of it.
I'm afraid you're going to spur a migration of 12-year-old American kids to China to join this this army. These guys actually they lived and worked in these places?
Yeah. And they were, in fact, all immigrants from other places, but they were all gamers. They had all, you know, it required a literacy in these games to do this work because it wasn't like, you know, another thing I imagined was they would be handed scripts by their bosses, you know, and say, you have to fight this monster, then that monster. And as, you know, you get up into a certain level, you have to do that. And in fact, you know, it was to a certain extent left up to them to improvise what the best strategies would be to, you know, to farm and so forth. And so though it was all work, there was a lot of, you know, mutual consultation about what the best strategy would be, and a lot of, you know, stuff that was very hard to distinguish from, you know, what regular players are doing.
Is there addiction counseling for this, for people who are too obsessed with this?
Yeah, there's a small but burgeoning industry of addiction counselors dealing with all kinds of online addiction. In China, they're especially concerned about it. China is experiencing an incredible boom with these things. And when I was there, you know, there were news accounts of you know, shelters for, you know, addicted young people in certain cities. You know, people were checking in there, and, you know, and they'll occasionally run stories of someone who dropped dead in an internet cafe, you know, after playing World of Warcraft for 80 hours straight or something. But, you know, again, it's hard to sort out the odd outlying case or the media sensationalism from, you know, the actual risk of addiction in these worlds.
One of the most remarkable things that you mention from China in the book is there was an actual murder over a virtual asset, right?
Yep. The story is pretty well confirmed. A fellow had lent a very valuable weapon, I think it was a sword, from one of these games to a friend who then turned around and sold it for real money. The guy was incensed, you know, went to the game company for redress. The game company, you know, sort of laughed at him. He went to the police for redress, who also shooed him away, and eventually went over to his friend's house, got into a big fight with him, and killed him with a real knife. And, you know, he's now in jail. And you know, that was a big news story in China. And partly in consequence of that kind of story, you'll find that the Chinese court system increasingly is much more sympathetic to the claims of players against game companies, that the game companies, in fact, are sort of fiduciary parties, you know, holding real assets for these people.
Well, Julian DeBell, what's fascinating about this whole game world is that we're now seeing corporations. This sounds strange, but they're paying money for a marketing presence in imaginary worlds, right?
Right, right. This is particularly the case of Second Life, but the real adventure there is that the players themselves are allowed to construct the world. They're given a toolkit with which to build objects and create and sell commodities, and therefore is starting to attract a certain amount of attention from companies that you know, have hitherto existed only in the real world. You know, American Apparel and has opened a shop in Second Life, and you can go in and buy, you know, American Apparel line items for your character. And so you have them. You have Honda recently released, you know, I think the prototype of its new Scion or whatever, inside the game. But what people are missing in this wave of publicity about, you know, the marketing efforts in Second Life is that there already was, before these big companies come in, a lot of people making a lot of money in Second Life, either creating brands that were very popular with the characters in there, clothing brands, furniture brands, or working in the real estate business there, which is hotter than hot. There's a woman who was on the cover of Business Week a few weeks ago named Ansha Chung, who makes millions buying land from the company as it creates it in this game and then sort of developing and then reselling it to players in the game.
Well, Julian DeBell, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Julian DeBell's book is called Play Money, or How I Quit My Day Job and Made Millions Trading Virtual Loot.